We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at Uni Church on the campus of UNSW, which was attended primarily by undergraduate and postgraduate students who lived on campus or in the suburbs surrounding the university.
All right, what about credulity? What's credulity? One who believes anything quickly and easily, right? Anytime. Yes, if that's what you say, I believe you. Do you see there's a problem in being in an age of sceptical credulity? There is a great problem. Let me take you down to the Macquarie Dictionary. See if we can read them. Are these going to be large enough for us to be reading? Here we go. Where am I going? In that direction, aren't I? Right? The sceptics, one who questions the validity or authenticity of something, purporting to be knowledge. One who mistrusts and who maintains a doubting, pessimistic attitude towards people's plans and ideas. One who doubts the truth of the Christian religion or of important elements of it. But it all comes from a philosophical background, really, from the ancient Greek world. And it's one who maintains that real knowledge of things is impossible. That's where it came from in the first place. And of course, if you believe real knowledge is impossible, then when anyone puts forward any knowledge, you immediately doubt it, don't you? And you start asking questions. Now, not many people hold to that particular point of scepticism. That's the end point of the sceptical spectrum. But it's the doubter, it's the questioner. And scepticism's a very good thing. It's a very, very useful tool. It's very valuable. I mean, we have a sceptic society in our country at the moment, and they have done, I think, some very valuable things in exposing fraudulent claims, in revealing shams and hoaxes and charlatans of people who make claims that they can do miraculous, marvellous things when it really is all done with mirrors, it's all the old hoax and tricks. And the sceptic society, who are committed to the view of doubting and questioning and querying, are the people who expose falsehood. It's important, of course, for anybody who's got an inquiring mind that there is an element of scepticism in it, isn't it? That we must be people who are going to ask the hard questions. Creative doubt is a very useful thing. But, of course, it has its danger, scepticism. In the end, it just pushes down to no knowledge at all. In the end, you never make a decision because you're still doubting. You never really buy your car because you can't trust anybody's word or any car or any manufacturer's warranty. So you actually stop living. The skeptic ultimately, when he reaches his end point, can never know anything. Because as the ancient skeptics pointed out, you've got to doubt your own doubts, haven't you? And you know, have I got the kind of mind that could ask the right question that would enable me to find out the flaw in the problem? And seeing I haven't got the right kind of mind, I can't even be sure that I've doubted properly. So I even doubt my own doubts. And scepticism, well, you'll never get married if you're a skeptic, will you? Because you'll never be sure that that person really loves you. Credulous, of course, and credibility is down the other end of the thing. Credulous has got to do with this believing anything. It all comes from the root word of cred, credo. Credible is something that is capable of being believed, believable, worthy of belief and confidence, trustworthy. Credulity is this disposition arising from weakness or ignorance, that's weakness of mind, presumably, to believe too readily. That's credulity, and credulous is the ready or disposed to believe, especially on weak and insufficient evidence, marked by and arising from credulity. Gullibility might be the other word you'd go for in this area, wouldn't you? It's that kind of, you say it, I believe it. Now, credulous people are nice kinds of people because they always go along with the crowd, and so they'll always be amongst your friends. They're easy people to please. They'll believe anything you tell them. In fact, they are the people who you can always play practical jokes on, because they'll always believe you and get sucked in. Credulity is fun people to have around. But it's very popular at the moment thanks to the New Age movement. I mean, the ultimate example of credulity is Shirley MacLaine. She believes anything and everything, it would seem. An interviewer recently asked her, "Is there anything you don't believe in?" All she did was get angry. One of my friends applied for a job for a computer company the other day, a graduate here and in computers, and he was getting his job in this company. And they asked him whether he had any religious beliefs, which he did, and because he did, they said, "Oh, we're very keen on having you take the job because we want people with religious beliefs in the job." He was thinking he was going to miss the job because he had religious beliefs, but there you are, it's the exact reverse. So they asked him to fill out the form that they wanted. What was the form all about? Well, they wanted to know what date he was born on and which year and whereabouts, because they wanted to make sure that he was astrologically in harmony with the rest of the people working in the computer company. That is a very interesting illustration, isn't it, of the state of our society, that the very high-tech people can be so credulous as to believe in the astrological nonsense. Of course, it is classic nonsense, and you have to be a little bit dim to go along that line. He took the job. They took him. He obviously has the right kind of whatever it is. It has a great strength, credulity, because it believes and it trusts and it relies, but it has tremendous weakness because it can be conned. It trusts lies, and people live very foolishly. Now, both of them are caught up with this idea of believing or faith, and that's a very religious-y Christian word. So I want us to take a moment or two to think about faith, as to what faith may be. Now, the Macquarie Dictionary is not bad, I think, in describing faith. It has a long definition of about 9 alternatives to it. Confidence or trust in a person or thing. That's a very good definition of faith in terms of what the Bible means by the word, in terms of how people use the word. But a way in which it is used very often today in Australia, and therefore quite right for the Macquarie Dictionary to put it there, is the second definition. Belief which is not based on faith. Sorry, on proof. Belief which is not based on proof. And of course at that point it is exactly the same as credulity, isn't it? Believing when you can't prove it. Third one, belief in the doctrines of the teaching of religion. Fourth, the doctrines which are or should be believed in, or a system of religious belief like the Christian faith, the Jewish faith. Six is a good one. It's very much like one, the obligation of loyalty or fidelity to a person, a promise, an engagement. And so you keep faith and you break faith. And then seventh is the observation of this obligation and so forth. Faith is a funny word, you see, because for many people, faith is something, it's almost like a product that you have. I was reading the Time magazine of this author who has written the Satanic Verses, and it describes him as having lost his faith some years ago in Islam. He lost his faith as if, you know, if you looked around his apartment, you could find it somewhere. You know, it's one of those things that you lose. And that's the kind of funny, wobbly language like falling pregnant. I always wonder why people who have some idea about biology think that it happens by falling. That's you're walking along one day and you fell pregnant. Well, likewise, you're walking along one day and you lost your keys and you also lost your faith. It's a funny usage of the phrase, of the word, to lose your faith, because that really doesn't fit in with many of the definitions that are given on faith. And for many people who are sceptical, faith is always belief which is not based on proof. And so Christians are challenged to, well, people are challenged to become Christians on the basis that you can't possibly know, so you may as well. But when in doubt, when there is all the evidence backed against it, when it seems completely stupid, then that's when you believe the most. And at that point, Christianity is credulity. Well, let's come to the word of the Bible tonight that we're going to be looking at in Luke chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. Luke 1, 1 to 4. many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. And therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. If you're not in a position where you can see a Bible, do glare at the person next to you and make sure you remember to bring your Bible next week, but they'll share it to you. If anyone not be able to see a Bible, because there's two or three of you sitting there without Bibles, just raise your hand, we'll pass one to you. Everyone see the text of the Scriptures in front of us? Anyone not see it? Put your hand up if you can't see it. We're more than happy to share it along with you. Good, because you need to just... We're only doing a little passage tonight. Usually we do about a chapter. So that's four verses tonight. This passage introduces us to divine history. History, no mistake about it, but history that involves and includes God. So we're dealing with a double thing here. We're dealing with history just like any other piece of history, but history that's not like any other piece of history because it's got a supernatural element to it, because it's going to deal with the subject of God. But first, look at the historical features. You see, the author tells us that there are already documents in existence that he knows about, that other people have already written down what he has written down, what he is about to write down, and they're known to him. He's not claiming to be unique. He's not claiming to be the only source of information. There are other sources as well, many other sources, and indeed, he is using other sources. That's part of Luke's writing. Now, it is commonly said that he uses Mark's gospel, and it seems to me there's every evidence that he does because there are many verses which are identical. Well, it's possible that both he and Mark used another source somewhere down the track, but it looks as if he was well acquainted with Mark's gospel, for example, as there are indications that Matthew also looked like he knew Mark's gospel. And so there has been much study done in the last 100 years, thanks to historians, to look at how Luke and how Matthew used the sources that they had available to them, how carefully they preserved the truth and how much they varied it. Now, Hoskins and Davies, two British scholars, they investigated. Let me give you some summaries. If you come regularly here, you'll find that I don't use overheads very often at all. But something got hold of me this week. Hoskins and Davies, after an exhaustive comparison of Matthew and Luke's use of Mark, wrote, "The authors of the two later Gospels are concerned for their Greek readers, and they add in order to make clear what Jesus demanded of his disciples. They simplify in order to avoid crude misunderstandings. They omit what appears to be trivial and unnecessary. They order and arrange the tradition in that it may be more easily read in public or in private. And they improve the grammar and style in order that their intelligent readers may not be unreasonably provoked." That's what Luke does to Mark. You get Mark, you get Luke, you compare where the two are saying the same things and look at the differences. And after a careful, detailed analysis of it, which has been going on roughly for 100 years now amongst academic circles, that's the kind of conclusion you will come to. That there are variations, but they are the kinds of variations. And so, in the whole, they summarise it like this. In the whole of this process of editing, they nowhere heighten Mark's tremendous conception of Jesus. There's no deifying of a prophet or of a mere preacher of righteousness that can be detected. In other words, they don't fundamentally improve the story. The writers conclude in these ways. Two things can be said with confidence about Matthew and Luke. First, as we check their use of Mark, we find that Matthew and Luke are responsible scribes who do not exaggerate the material at their disposal. Second, we discover that hidden within their gospel, strands which existed before Matthew and Luke wrote as sources of information about Jesus. The evidence for what Jesus did and said is significantly more extensive and complex than we might expect from the four gospels as they stand. That's what Luke says. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that you've heard about. Many, many accounts, you see. And what he is dealing with here are the sources. And when we check out him, we check out how he uses his sources. And we find that he was a faithful scribe who certainly made changes to bits and pieces, polishing up the Greek grammar. Mark's Greek was very bad. Luke's Greek, especially in the first four verses, is very good. Polishing up the Greek grammar. After that, he seems to have slipped back into a fairly poor, bad Greek, but he knew how to do it, at least for four verses. Polishes up the Greek here and there. He edits, he takes away the trivial detail, but he substantially leaves it, and he doesn't in any way fundamentally change it or improve upon what he already had. But it's not only written documents that Luke says he's working in, he's also working with traditions. And not old and long traditions, but things that were handed down orally. Oral traditions were handed down. Things that were fulfilled amongst us. You see, it's not very long ago that we were there, but have been handed down by the eyewitnesses. That is, Luke is in touch with the first generation, if not being one himself. You can't be sure from these verses. The first generation taught him, and they taught him publicly, not privately, they taught us. So he has access to written accounts of the events of Jesus, and he has access to spoken accounts of what has taken place. History both written and oral. The history of the Second World War, I've read several books on. I've read Churchill or some of Churchill's accounts of the Second World War, did that late last year. A cut-down children's version, seeing his runs to six or seven volumes. But I read that. But I've also spoken to my father and my father-in-law about what they were doing at the time, and I compared the notes, and it wasn't quite the same as Churchill, but it all fitted together, and I could go back and find out details that you'll never find out from Churchill about what it was like and how it happened, and ask more questions and fit the pieces together. And notice these oral sources were eyewitnesses from the very first. Luke may have been a second generation Christian, but the people he was dealing with were first generation Christians. They were eyewitnesses. When it says they were eyewitnesses from the first, it most likely means the apostles. Because in Acts chapter 1, which we'll be dealing with in campus Bible study, and hope you'll be there with us on Tuesday and Thursday lunchtime at Matthew's A, I'll be dealing with Acts 1. Acts 1, you'll find that the basis of being selected as an apostle was that you were there from the time of John the Baptist all the way through the ministry of Jesus, including the resurrection and afterwards when you saw him go. That's what was required of an eyewitness. They're the kinds of eyewitnesses he's dealing with, the ones that were eyewitnesses from the very first, the people who were there the whole way through the Jesus event and therefore saw it all. They're the ones he's been talking to. So he's got first-hand, not remote, information about what took place. And he says more than that, I myself have been involved in investigating it. He's not just reliant on documents, he's not just reliant on traditions, but he says, I've followed everything myself. Indeed, I've followed it carefully. I've carefully investigated what is taking place. The following up the events, indeed, from the beginning, he has done that. Everything, right from the beginning. And so we find in Luke's Gospel, he goes back and presumably it seems he's talked to Mary, because there are little hints about Mary, about how she remembered what happened, that Luke has gone and talked to her so that he's investigated from the very birth of Jesus what this was all about, these events that are taking place. And so now his goal has been to write an orderly account for this man Theophilus. For history is not only research and investigation built upon documents and witnesses and careful in researching out things. History is also writing. History is gathering together your material, selecting out which materials. You don't write everything when you write history. You select out the bits that are going to tell the story and you set it out in order so that it makes sense, so that you can present it. That is what you have in Luke's Gospel. You have history. G.B. Caird is a retired Oxford scholar now, I think he's retired now, not a man who you would describe as a Bible believer, but a man who has done enormous research, both in Canada, where he was a professor there for a while, and in most of his life in Oxford, in the historical background of Christianity. Here's his comment about Luke. You won't find it there because it's on that sheet of paper. There you'll find it. The account we have given of Luke's literary procedure consists entirely of deductions drawn from careful study of his gospel. but it coincides almost exactly with what he himself has to tell us in his prologue. There he claims that the story he is about to recount in his two-volume work, because Luke writes Acts as well, is solid truth based on eyewitness evidence, that some of this evidence has come to him through the writings of others and some directly, and that he himself has been conducting his researches for some time past, or he may mean that he is personally involved in the events he has recorded, that is, since AD 49 when he joined Paul at Troas. As far as the Gospel is concerned, and we cannot here undertake to discuss the historicity of Acts, Luke has made good his claim to be a trustworthy historian, provided we don't make the blunder of judging him by the canons of modern scientific historiography. There are differences between an ancient historian and a modern one, but in terms of the normal meaning of the word history writing, Luke did it. And people like Caird, who's not a Bible believer, and who just spends his life, because the English are a bit quaint about what they'll spend their life doing, studying the details, comparing verses and verses, words and words, studying with enormous details this book, he says strange, strange things. When I've analysed it and pulled it apart and teased it and compared it with Mark's gospel and what I know about the first century and everything else, it seems to me that Luke wrote the book just like he said he did. Well, that's good news, isn't it? Could have saved himself a lot of time, but if you're a sceptic, you don't save yourself time, you investigate, don't you? You ask, you doubt, you don't just take a man's word. Well, Mr. Caird, he's done the right thing for the sceptics. But while it's history, it's also divine history. Now that gives the sceptic, like Mr. Caird, terrible problems. Because we're not recounting what happened. Luke is not recounting what accidentally, randomly occurred. Notice what Luke says. He is recounting what was fulfilled. Funny word, isn't it? The things that have been fulfilled amongst us. Because Luke saw a grand plan in history. The history was starting somewhere and going somewhere under the supervision of God. How do you view history? It's a great problem, those of you historians, isn't it? What is history? Is history just random events that happen? Or is history going somewhere? Has it got a beginning and is it heading somewhere? I mean, I know we always think we're the pinnacle of it, but every generation does, especially the ones we think are fairly barbaric now. Where is history going? Is there any rhyme or reason? How can you write history? Do you just collect every fact that's ever been in the past because everything is equally significant? No. You think some things are significant, do you? On what basis are they significant? Why is it more significant to know Winston Churchill's name than it is to know my mother's name? Why is he more significant than her? On what basis do you draw that? Luke has a very clear basis. God had a plan, and God foretold his plan to the prophets of Israel. He said certain things were going to happen, and the things he said were going to happen have happened, and we were eyewitnesses of them. And so the prophecies of old, the plan of old, has been fulfilled in our presence. And I'm writing to you about what has been fulfilled. And so the eyewitnesses couldn't remain eyewitnesses. The eyewitnesses become servants of the Lord, as they're described. And at this point, the sceptic really raises his head and says, yes, in other words, they're all biased, aren't they? That's the kind of eyewitnesses he's got, the one-eyed eyewitnesses. They're the only type that Christians can come up with, the ones who already believe and therefore are to be discounted. Funny thing, this, really. Because at that point, Christianity can never win, can it? I mean, it's like the censorship debate. Have you ever contemplated the censorship debate? Well, again, we're seeing it at the moment with the satanic verses. But a dirty movie comes out, and you get interviewed as to whether or not people should go to this dirty movie, and they say, have you seen it? Now, if you say no, I say, well, how do you know what you're talking about? And if you say yes, then they say, well, did it affect you badly? If you say, yes, it has, they say, well, we can't trust anything you said because your mind's been affected by it. And if you say no, they say, hasn't affected you, therefore why should it affect anybody else? You can't win that debate, can you? Sometimes, you know, what you've got to do is you've got to call garbage, garbage. You know, there just is a possibility that there's a category that you can't analyse like that. But that's another story. It's like this with Christianity and witnesses, though. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. You see, every eyewitness of the resurrection became a Christian. Of course they did. What kind of eyewitness of the resurrection is not going to become a Christian? But because they've become a Christian, people then say, well, now they're biased, so they're no good as eyewitnesses. What we want is an eyewitness of the resurrection who didn't become a Christian. Now, if we had one like that, then we would know it happened. That right? No. They still wouldn't know it's happened. They'll still doubt it. Let me show you. Josephus was a Jewish writer of the first century, late first century. He was not an eyewitness of the resurrection, but he wrote a history of the Jews. He wrote a history of the Jews for the Romans because he betrayed... Well, it's a long story why he did it. It doesn't matter all that much. And as he wrote, he said this about Jesus in his history, written for the Romans of the whole Jewish nation. It's a very big book. About this time arose Jesus, a wise man, if indeed it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful deeds and a teacher of men who gladly received the truth. He drew to himself many, both of the Jews and of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, on the indictment of the principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, those who had loved him at the first did not cease to do so, for he appeared to them again alive on the third day. The divine prophets, having foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things about him, and even to this day, a race of Christians who are named from him has not died out. There is a first century Jewish writer telling us of the history of Christ, that Jesus was the Christ who rose from the dead. Here's a commentary written by a modern skeptic about it. He says over here, a wise man. This doesn't seem to be a Christian description of Jesus. Josephus probably civilizing Jesus, as did John. If indeed it be lawful to call him a man, or this on the other hand is almost certainly a Christian addition. One who is not a Christian would have no hesitation in calling Jesus a man. Many of the Gentiles, this line, either is of a Christian interpolation of Josephus, his writing out of his knowledge of the present state of the church, but dig this line. He was the Christ. This must be a Christian interpolation. It's quite impossible to make Josephus's words mean he was believed to be the Christ, and of course Josephus, being a Jew, would never say he was the Christ, would he? He appeared to them, these words must have been written by a Christian. We have not got one copy of Josephus that shows any of those words missing. Every copy of Josephus we've got includes all those words. But when it comes to it, you see, the doubter will always doubt, won't he? So that if you got a non-Christian who said, yes, I'm an eyewitness, I saw it, they'll say, oh, no, no, someone's fiddled the account there, haven't they? I've got no evidence they've fiddled the account, except for the fact that a non-Christian would never say such a thing. You see, yeah, you can't win, can you? If you're committed to doubt, if you're committed to scepticism, you're committed to knowing nothing. That's the end point of scepticism. I think Josephus most likely was fiddled with. I think it's quite likely. Certainly the Slavonic version of Josephus has been fiddled with. Not in those terms there. I think it's quite likely. But what I'm saying is, doubt, the skeptic's doubt on bias, is an unreasonable one. It's totally unreasonable. Because it can never be proved wrong. There's no way you can prove it wrong. Because in the end, everybody is biased. And no one is more biased than the skeptic. Because he is committed to doubt. Even before he's looked at any of the evidence. So they become servants of the word, these people. And that's significant for Christians, of course. Because if Christianity is right, then the eyewitnesses have actually become what the eyewitnesses should, servants of the word of God. But Luke is telling us in the first four verses of why he is writing this book. He's writing it to a man called Theophilus, of whom we know nothing, other than he wrote volume two as well to him. And he was an excellent man, which may be a title of some kind. The word Theophilus, the name, means a lover of God, so it may be a pseudonym even. We don't know much about him. But notice the reason for which Luke writes here at the end of the verse 4. So that you may know the certainty of the things that have been taught. Luke is writing so that this man will be sure that what he has been taught is true. That the things taught to him stand on solid basis. He's not saying so that you might know the things that you experienced, but so that you might know the things that you have been taught, that they are true. We've been taught all kinds of things about Jesus, haven't we? Who he was and when he lived and where he lived and what he did. But how do you know any of those things are true? How do you know that you're not just being credulous, gullible? Your mother told you, your grandmother told you. You see, the skeptic who will not accept Christianity because he will not accept anything is a blithering idiot. But the Christian who believes it all without thinking is a blithering idiot. They are both in the same category of idiocy, aren't they? Because they are not really using their minds. One is using his mind so as to avoid reality. The other is avoiding reality and his mind. You've been taught things, and here's the problem for Australians, isn't it? We all have a smattering of Christianity. Some of us even went through the agonies of going to go through a church school where we've got more than a smattering, we've got a drumming of Christianity. We all got this smattering of it. We know that there is a thing called a Bible, there is a thing called a Jesus, there is a thing called 10 commandments and 12 apostles, or was it 12 commandments and 10 apostles? But we know there's all those kinds of things running around. Why, there's even a Lord's Prayer that occasionally we might be able to rattle out. But which part's true and which part isn't? What is the truth of it? And how will we know what is true? And so, in an age of credulous scepticism, this is what we get. We get the credulous response, those people who think it's all true and believe it every bit. They also believe in Islam and Buddha and Baha'i and Judaism and Shirley MacLaine. Indeed, they believe that Elvis still lives. Some of them are more Christianized than that, and they just believe in Christianity. And when you say why, they say, well, because my mother told me. Well, they wouldn't say it publicly, but that's about the level of it. And when we talk like this, as this sermon goes on and as we look at this passage, they say, Philip, get on with it. Why don't we just get to singing? Why don't we get to supper? Why don't we just enjoy it? Why are you bothering ticking down little phrases and words and meanings of words? Why don't we just be Christian? Because that's not being Christian, is the answer. This man thought it was important. And I'd back this man. We get the credulous response, those people who think it's all true and believe it every bit. They also believe in Islam and Buddha and Baha'i and Judaism and Shirley MacLaine. Indeed, they believe that Elvis still lives. Some of them are more Christianized than that, and they just believe in Christianity. And when you say why, they say, well, because my mother told me. Well, they wouldn't say it publicly, but that's about the level of it. And when we talk like this, as this sermon goes on and as we look at this passage, they say, Philip, get on with it. Why don't we just get to singing? Why don't we get to supper? Why don't we just enjoy it? Why are you bothering ticking down little phrases and words and meanings of words? Why don't we just be Christian? Because that's not being Christian, is the answer. This man thought it was important. And I'd back this man's Christianity against yours any day. He thought it was important that we know the basis of the things that we have been taught. Credulity is not Christian. Likewise, the skeptic has his response, well, it's all biased. He's only written it for money or for fame or or Theophilus was a government officer and he was trying to get in the good books with him, or he was trying to con him into believe. I mean, it's just one of those propaganda tracks. But it's always impossible to be unbiased, friends. Luke is laying out his biases right up front and telling you where he knows, what he knows, and what he's trying to do. Right up front. There's no hidden agenda with it. Now, if you start doubting before you even look, if you doubt, doesn't matter what he says, no, well, you'll not find the truth. Not that you just won't find it here, you won't find it anywhere. Because the way of doubt leads you to doubt. That's the only place it'll ever lead you to, apart from a psychiatric hospital. So note the thought form that we have here. The thought form of Luke, the thought form of genuine Christianity. It's not credulity and it's not scepticism. But credible, believable supernaturalism. He putting forward a thing that he says happened, and he wants you to see that what happened is credible. It's believable. Because he has the evidences for it. I want you to know the certainty of what you have been taught. And so I'm going to provide for you the researched, orderly presented evidences of what you have been taught. And so as you begin the year, or for some of us begin our university stay, I want to encourage you into research, into investigation, into looking at the basis of what you have been taught. We've discovered that most University of New South Wales students in the surveys we have conducted have never read the New Testament. We've also discovered that they are never short in telling us what they think Christianity is about. Everybody has an opinion on Christianity, but nearly everybody is ignorant of what the New Testament itself says. Blessings upon your head, here you are, looking yourselves. I mean, you're obviously not amongst that large group. Well, if the only four verses of the New Testament you've ever looked at are the four that you've just looked at tonight, you don't know much yet. Can I encourage you? You need to investigate further. We don't want anybody to become a Christian on the basis of ignorance, credulity. We want people to question, to query, to investigate, to search, to research, to think, to analyse, to look at the basis upon which the claims are made. But of course, we don't want people to be so sceptical that they won't even open their bleary eyes to look. They won't even approach it with a reasonable mind. Sir William Ramsay, late last century, was a Scot who went to Oxford and studied there and became one of the first professors of archaeology there, and had profound doubts, thanks to German scholarship of a particular kind of the 19th century, about the historicity of the New Testament, and especially of Luke's Gospel and Acts. He thought they were written in the 2nd century. He then did a long life's work investigating Turkey, much of the area that was travelled through in the book of Acts. And he discovered, to his surprise, that Luke, rather than being written in the 2nd century and totally ignorant of the Turkey of the 1st century, was one of the best sources for the whole subject of Turkey in the 1st century. That in detail after detail, Luke knew so much that he could have only known it if he was there at the time. And that the 2nd century hypothesis for the writing of Luke's Gospel and the book of Acts, completely impossible. Here, he said, I may fairly claim to have entered on this investigation without prejudice in favour of the conclusion which I shall now seek to justify to the reader. On the contrary, I began with a mind unfavourable to it, for the ingenuity and apparent completeness of the Tubingen theory, the German theory, had at one time quite convinced me. I did not then lie in my line of life to investigate the subject minutely, but more recently I found myself brought into contact with the book of Acts as an authority for the topography, antiquities and society of Asia Minor. It was gradually borne upon me that in various details the narrative showed marvellous truth. In fact, beginning with a fixed idea that the work was essentially a second century composition and never relying on its evidence as trustworthy for the first century conditions, I gradually came to find it as a useful ally in some obscure and difficult investigations. He goes on to say it is a thoroughly trustworthy history. Indeed, Sir William Ramsay came to be a very firmly convinced Bible-believing Christian through his archaeological investigations on the Gospel of Luke and his writing in the book of Acts, just from the point of view of history. This challenge to investigate would be a nothing if the book was a nothing, if the things that have been fulfilled were nothing. I want you to investigate what my mother's maiden name is. He said, we're not all that interested in your mother, let alone her maiden name. In fact, we're just surprised that you had a mother. No, big deal. I say, I want you to investigate the rumour that I've just heard that a particular group of wild-eyed fanatics have left a bomb under our building here. That is a very different kind of claim to my mother's maiden name, isn't it? It has an existential impact upon you, one could say, that is radically different. The things that are claimed here is that God's plan for the universe came to fulfilment in the person of Jesus. That this man lived and died and rose again and has overcome death. That this man now rules the universe. This man now rules you. In fact, when you die, this is the man to whom you are going to be personally answerable for everything you ever thought or have done. That this man actually was God. That is not Philip's mother-in-law's maiden name kind of information. That is bomb under the building kind of information, isn't it? For if this is true, this is what life is about. This is what death is about. This is what existence is about. This is even what the University of New South Wales is about. This is what you are about. If it's not true, well then, it's a great tyranny that you need to liberate the world from. Because it's fouled up so many lives. Well, do you want to ask questions or make comments about what's been said this evening? Sorry?
You used the word historicity.
Give me the sentence I used it in, I will. But historicity is a word?
Yes, yes. You said that...
How I'm using the word.
The last person you were talking about, the guy who was a Scot, that severely doubted the historicity.
Okay, in that sense, it would be meaning he doubted the historical reliability of it. Oh, hello, sorry. Yes, it says there are many have taken to draw up accounts. Does that mean then there will be other gospels that could be floating around even today or have been destroyed or there are more than just the four we've got? Yeah, we know of other gospel accounts that have been written. There were many after Luke that have been written as well. There are many spurious and phony ones as well. Now, we don't know of many prior to Luke, but presumably from what he's saying, there were. But we haven't got accounts of them now. But you can find, they sell it in the bookshops all the time, the secret sayings of Jesus by the Gospel according to St. Thomas. And people keep on turning it out as some new discovery. It's been around for a long time now, and we've known about it. But there's also the Gospel of Peter, which was written in the second century by a man whose name wasn't Peter and who was found out and was forced to recant. And there's the Gospel of Thecla, isn't it? T-H-E-C-L-A-R. And there's the Gospel. There's all kinds of them. You'll find them in a book by M.R. James called New Testament Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. New Testament Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha, M.R. James. It's a thick volume. It's about three times the length of the New Testament. And, sorry? Costs a fortune, doesn't it? Yeah, well, it'll be in the university library. It's a very famous and important work. And M.R. James gathered up all the bits that were dropped out, so to speak, that were left behind for various reasons, like the Gospel of Peter. Once they found out who wrote it and he wasn't Peter and he was in the second century, no one believes it as the Gospel anymore. But you'll find extracts of it there in that book, you see, because it's an interesting second century writing of a Christian background. And it's worth studying as that, provided you don't get yourselves confused as to thinking that it comes from the Apostle Peter, because we know it was a fraud. Now, the New Testament is not the only Christian writings that we have. There's a whole batch of Christian writings. But these are the ones, through all our sifting, that have stood up to the test of analysis as having come from the period of time they claim to have come from and been written by the people they claim to have been written by, and therefore can stand in a way quite different to the pseudepigraphers, which means false writings, and apocrypha, which means hidden writings. Well, Hebrews makes no claim as to who the author is, so you can never say that he's wrong. Right? But, yeah, can we say it's reliable? We need to be checking back then to see whether it is reliable, whether it is consistent with what the New Testament says is the apostolic gospel, whether it's consistent with what we know of first century Israel. You can work out that Hebrews is written very early on a very simple basis, that it keeps on talking about the temple as something that is still existing when we know it was destroyed in AD 70. So when someone writes the history of the temple, as now, of course, I mean, you can say, aha, he was a clever devil. He was actually in the second century and he kept on writing back in the past tense. Well, that could be so. It's worth investigating to see. We can also find where these things are quoted in other sources. 2 Peter is also one that's queried. Every book of the New Testament has been queried. Every one. Now, if you get a book by Donald Guthrie, Donald G-U-T-H-R-I-E, he has written a large tome called New Testament Introduction. It's published by Tyndale Press or by InterVarsity Press. Donald Guthrie, he goes through every book of the New Testament. He tells you all the major inquiries of scepticism, of reasonable scepticism and unreasonable scepticism, all the major inquiries into who wrote it, when and why it couldn't have been the apostles. And then he shows you how each one of them has been demonstrated to be inaccurate. And you can do it on every book of the New Testament. And Mr. Guthrie made his name out of producing this great book called The New Testament Introduction. Now, there are still things up in the air. There are still things to investigate. 2 Peter is one of the odd ones, because 2 Peter has a writing style different to 1 Peter. And 2 Peter has many verses that are very similar to Jude. And so you start scratching your head and you say, well, how can this be? And there are other explanations to it. I mean, 1 Peter tells you that it's been written by the hand of Silvanus. That is, the scribe may not be just taking it down dictation-wise, the scribe might be writing it and Peter giving approval of it. There's all kinds of... I'm not saying that is the answer, by the way. I'm just saying that you've got to then investigate. But Donald Guthrie's book will take you through all the arguments on all the New Testament. It is reasonable and right to ask the questions. Absolutely reasonable and right to ask. You mustn't have the childish Christianity of credulity, which is, oh, don't ask any questions, just take it as it is. Because if that is the case, you've been sold a bill of goods and you don't know it. I mean, you happen to be Christian, but you could be believing the same thing about the Quran, couldn't you? Or you could be believing the same thing about anything. No, you can't do it. You must think, indeed, it's Christian to ask what is the basis. However, you mustn't go down scepticism as the way of belief, because scepticism is the way of doubt. Scepticism leads to ignorance. It can never actually lead to truth. Somewhere along the line, you've got to say, yes, that is reasonable. That is credible.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.